this week, our hunt for the Wilder People director is over because we have Taika Waititi on this week's podcast, plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that thinks Doctor Strange was wrong. Nobody did forget Spider-Man because they went to see it to the tune of $1 billion.
Oh boy.
Cut a check for one Mr. P. Parker. Esquire Stat. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast this week. Two colleagues of such lethal cunning are with me in the pod booth. One is Helen O'Hara, Geek Queen. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
One is the man who looks more like George Harrison than the man they cast to play George Harrison in the Beatles biopics. It is, of course, John Nugent.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Sam Mendes, call me. I'm available.
Yeah, we can do reshoots.
There's still time.
Yeah. I have an iPhone. We can reshoot. I know you have Greg Fraser doing the DP duties over there in your Beatles movies, but I think Chris Hewitt shooting something on an iPhone in a badly lit studio.
Yeah, what's Greg Fraser ever... Oh, wait, no, I've just looked and he has shot many, many interesting
things. Yeah, but
Yeah, really well. Actually,
really well?
Really, like, I'm like, sorry, but like...
Knows what he's doing?
Like, pretty... thoroughly knows.
All right, yeah. Greg Fraser, if you're listening to this, and I know you are. Okay, here's a little test. What is a key light? That is your question for next week. Write in your answer to me, Greg Fraser. I accept MasterCard. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Blue Sky. Imagine Greg Fraser slid into my DMs to tell me what a key light is. And you want to know the twist? I don't know what a key light is. Anyway.
It's for lighting keys.
Oh, that's it. That's it.
This question was brought to you by Chris remembering to turn on the lights in the studio a few minutes into the podcast.
No, that's not true.
That's 100% true.
No. The discussion of the lights was organic and prompted me to remember that I hadn't turned on the lights in the studio.
Yeah.
It wasn't the other way around.
Okay.
So,
but
chicken
hang
and egg.
On. You accept MasterCard, so you want Greg Fraser to pay you.
Yes.
To... tell him
yeah.
to tell you the answer
John,
to tell your you question.
John, I need an out, man. I need an out.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right, so I accept MasterCard. So Greg Fraser, please do slide into my DMs. I am CTAH1976 on Instagram. Just send me your card details.
and tell me
what a key light is. And we'll say no more about it.
Wow.
And the feud will be over.
There is no feud.
My famous feud with Greg Fraser, genius cinematographer. But there we go. Anyway, John's going to be replacing Joseph Quinn in the Beatles.
Great.
Movie.
Wow.
Okay, wow. Yeah. Well done. I mean, congratulations, I guess.
Thanks.
Commiserations to Joseph Quinn.
Yeah.
And, I imagine we'll be fine.
I'm afraid there's bad news for Shifty Barry.
Oh, no.
Because he's been replaced as Ringo.
By you.
Yeah, that was the idea. That was a general idea, yeah. But peace and love. Do not send me any more panic Jorgens. They're going in the bin.
Do you think the Ringo film will get to the Thomas the Tank Engine stuff? Do you think
yes.
it will cover that?
I think this is what Sam Mendes is. He's been stealth making a Thomas the Tank Engine origin story.
Do you think at the end it will be like
so tired?
The post credits thing will be like the fat controller being like, "I'm putting together a team."
Ringo will come home. "I'm putting a team together. Richard Starkey. I've written a book about a talking tank engine. His name is Thomas."
Right.
He's played by Ian McKellen, by the way.
Explains.
I was starting as someone else, but then I went a bit McKellen-y, so I leaned into it. Yeah. So,
right.
And he's like, "You think there's more than one narrating beetle in the world, Mr. Stark, eh?" "Oh, wait, there's someone in my house."
Good
Writes
Lord.
Itself, Helen! Itself.
Let's hope it does.
Okay. Shot brilliantly, of course, by Greg Fraser.
Yeah, probably.
I'm listening. All right. Shall we dispense with the small talk?
How
are you? How are you both?
I'm well. I went to see the Game of Thrones play this week.
Yes.
Up in Stratford-upon-Avon.
Wow.
At the Royal Shakespeare Company. Because people have been saying for years, "Oh, these books are Shakespearean." And they've obviously gone, "Shit, are they? Should we be covering this?"
Oh, they were written by someone else.
Don't you know
it was Shakespearean. Shakespeare didn't write it.
Actually, this was written by someone other than George R.R. Martin, who's obviously real busy, hopefully, writing The Winds of Winter.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
But
he's right at it.
Right, hard, nose to the grindstone, as ever, hard at it. But yeah, so this is a sort of an adaptation of basically around Robert's Rebellion and the tournament at Harrenhal that just preceded that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the backstory of like Ned Stark and Robert Baratheon and those characters and how that's led to Robert's Rebellion and the war.
So does it have the Mad King then?
It's called the Mad King.
It's called the Mad King. Yeah. There we go.
I'm burying the lead, one of the leads. Anyway,
Game of Thrones does quite regularly.
And no spoilers for this one, but if you know your Westeros history, there'll be some burials. But yeah, this is like Crown Prince Rhaegar.
Not Rhaegar.
No, he's like good in this, it turns out. He's like interesting.
Yeah.
Kind of looks like the lead of one of those romantasy books.
Who's in this? Any famouses?
Not really. There's a lot of familiar faces that you would know, but actually two of the leads, as far as I can tell, basically the guy who plays Rhaegar and the guy who plays Robert Baratheon.
Yes.
And even the guy who plays Ned, practically straight out of drama school.
Oh.
And they're really good. Really, really good.
Good drama schools.
Good drama schools, yeah. I was impressed.
How old is Ned and Robert at this point?
They're meant to be about, like, I think they're meant to be about, like late teens, early 20s, basically.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure exactly. It wasn't, they didn't put a number on it. So yeah. But it's set 15 to 17 years before Game of Thrones. 15 in the books, 17 in the TV show, because they wanted the kids to be a bit older.
Right.
And this is basically the story about, yeah, everything going a bit skew-if and Robert becoming king instead of one of the Targaryens.
And this is a lavish production?
Oh, yeah.
Handsomely mounted?
Yeah, there are, like, literally mounted, because there are, like, puppet horses that people ride on. And there is a full-on tournament through the middle of the theatre. The stage is cross-shaped through the middle of the theatre, and you have, like, a literal, like a full Knight's Tale thing going
like
on
jousting.
In the middle. Like jousting. Yeah.
Like puppet jousting.
Puppet jousting. And there is a dragon at one point, because somebody has a vision.
Cool.
I know, obviously, in the history, the dragons are dead at that point, but full-scale dragon.
Full scale. This sounds incredible.
I had the best time.
What
so
did
good.
You make of the key light?
The key lighting was really quite spectacular. They used it very well.
Yeah.
It's right. Not like Morticia Addams in the Addams Family, which to me is like the ultimate key light. You know the way in the Addams Family she has a light across
She's
her eyes like the entire time?
Yeah.
That to me
right.
is like...
Just so I'm clear, do you actually know what a key light is? Because I'm not sure.
Well,
jokes aside...
John... I'm afraid that's for Greg Fraser to answer.
Okay. We're still waiting on
no
that.
No spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers. Let's see what happens next week. Oh, other DPs are allowed to chip in if you are a DP.
Oh, that's very generous.
Roger.
Roger!
If you're listening.
The Deeks. Yeah. Sir, the Deeks to you. You jackanape. Please do send in what you think is a key light. Maybe I'll get it right. Maybe I'll get it wrong. We'll see. Anyway, I was in Dublin. At the weekend. I went to see Comedy Bang Bang over there in Dublin.
So this is a podcast that isn't us.
That's correct.
Hmm.
I mean, you do a podcast that isn't us. You do several podcasts that aren't us.
Yeah, but not quite as successfully as Comedy Bang Bang.
That's
How
true.
Was it? How was it fun?
Oh, it was brilliant.
Hey.
It was grand. It was really, really fun. It was Scott Aukerman and Paul F. Tompkins and Andy Daly, who are three geniuses, and they were joined on stage by Fred Armisen.
Oh, cool.
Ooh, another
Fred
genius.
Fred Armisen, who was in town, I believe, shooting Wednesday.
Ooh.
But he stayed around until Friday to do his guest appearance. No, he was shooting the television show Wednesday featuring Morticia Addams.
Oh, my God.
Do they do the same thing in that show as they do?
Not
in
really,
the...
no.
Okay.
It's Netflix lighting, isn't it? Just saying.
Oh, they can afford many key lights.
Yeah, they could.
Yeah.
They don't.
And it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
And he's Uncle Fester in it.
Yes, but he wasn't Uncle Fester in his Comedy Bang Bang appearance.
No.
He was two different characters.
Because of copyright.
Although they don't give a shit on that show. He could very easily have played Fester, but I think that maybe was a little bit too close to home. It's like a busman's holiday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was tons of fun watching Andy Daly and Paul F. Tompkins, who are, I think, two of the best improvisers on earth, just kind of going back and forth between characters. It was very, very funny. It was kind of awe-inspiring watching them do it.
Have you ever listened to The Thrilling Adventure Hour with Paul F. Tompkins in that?
I've listened to you talking about it. Is that the same?
It's pretty similar, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but you should. It's really
No, it sounds right up my boulevard. Mm-hmm. So maybe I will get around to that. But that was fantastic. John, what did you do? Okay, let's move on.
Oh, thanks.
John, we don't have time for this.
Okay, sorry.
What did you do? What did you get up to at the weekend?
At the weekend, I went to a Wilderness Festival, actually.
Oh, you did a Q&A.
I did a Q&A at Wilderness Festival.
An impromptu Q&A.
Which I found out about the
key
day
lights?
Before.
Okay. Oh, was it with Greg Fraser?
No, there was no key. Well, there was the sun. That was the keyest light.
That's the keyest light of all.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest, yeah. the keyest of all lights.
As George Harris once said, here comes the sun.
Here comes the sun.
Boy.
Yeah.
Here comes the key light, as he might have sung. Yeah, I did a really good Q&A with, and I'm
whoa,
saying
whoa,
that.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay.
I'm saying that because the people I was interviewing were interesting, not myself.
Okay.
I barely did any talking. I spoke to Lorna Tucker and Seamus McGarvey, who happens to be a cinematographer, actually.
Oh my gosh.
So
yes.
Maybe we should get him on.
Do you have his number?
Light.
Do you have his number?
I've got his email address, so I can
email him right now. Seamus McGarvey. What is a key light?
I think he would know. I should have asked on the Q&A.
Damn it. I had an opportunity.
This is absolutely wild. You had literally, you were exposed to a cinematographer, the most nervous and shy and reclusive of all film crew beasts.
Are we sure
they're
that's the
very,
case?
Very rarely he seen was, in public.
He was very,
he's
very nice
man,
and garrulous. Yeah. Yeah. He was not shy or reclusive at all.
Wow. This is amazing.
Yeah. So I was talking about their new film, Bear, which is coming out, I think, next year, which is an adaptation of Lorna's memoir. And it sounds really good. Lorna, I think, has mostly done like documentaries. She did Someone's Daughter, Someone's Son, which came out last year.
Right.
Very, very good film. But yeah, it was a very fun sort of last minute thing to do. I was there for my girlfriend, who was also doing a talk for her book,
which is very good.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, because she's got a book.
She has a book. She has written a very good book called Who Wants to Live Forever? Hannah Thomas will say on shelves now.
Should we move on?
I think we should.
Shall we have a question?
Oh, God, please.
Okay, yeah, all right, please. All right, so we have, once again, I went to Instagram. Here's one from APH85, who says, and this will allow us to align the movie news section and the question section.
Oh,
which,
synergy.
Yes, which will end up with the highest box office total, Spider-Man, Brand New Day, or Avengers Doomsday. And this, of course, is in relation to the fact that Spider-Man Brand New Day had a pretty incredible opening weekend worldwide, and in fact, in the USFA, where it actually beat Avengers Endgame's 7-year-old, well, 6.5-year-old opening weekend record, posting $360 million in the States and grossed about $910, $920 million worldwide, which is the second highest opening weekend worldwide of all time, just behind Avengers Endgame. Now, this was a hell of a thing, shot in the arm. I believe this weekend was the highest weekend, the highest grossing weekend in the history of the US box office.
Yeah, it is, apparently.
With the Odyssey still doing very, very well and whatnot. Guys, what do you think, A, of the Spider-Man box office, and B, of APH85's question, which is going to be the victor von Doom at the end of it all?
Well, I think, you know, the box office is largely due to my 4-star review of the film, which tipped the balance into record-breaking territory. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? In a time when we are still talking about whether people are even going back to the cinemas, that it can break records like this. And also that a solo character could beat an Avengers movie. I mean, obviously there's inflation and things to account for, but that's still, it's pretty astonishing news.
Yeah.
And also that they did it without IMAX, which, you know, charge for more for tickets. You know, the Odyssey have still got the sort of monopoly on IMAX for the time being. I think they're switching
August,
back.
It's like this weekend, isn't it? Like it's got some IMAX screens. And of course, you know, Doomsday has Infinity Vision, so.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the Odyssey is going to have very long legs for that reason, because people are still dying to see that in IMAX and or 70mm IMAX. And so that's going to have a really long tail, I think, the Odyssey. It's going to be really interesting to see how that plays over the next month or two. But Spider-Man, this is a phenomenal result for all the reasons that you just said. I do feel like, though, this does, you know, pinpoint the fact that Spider-Man is now as big a deal in the movie. No, that's not fair. He has always been a big deal in the movies as well. I mean, the first Spider-Man, the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man broke box office records. That was the first one to make. Was it 100 or 200 in its opening weekend? It was a significant milestone.
100, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, even then, back in what, 2000 and I forget.
Two.
Thank you. But this is like exponentially better. And I think this might be bigger than Doomsday. Having said that, this is got to be good news at Marvel. Like this, you know, there has been a perception that Marvel has been struggling. Frankly, it has been struggling. Even perfectly good films like Thunderbolts and Fantastic Four have struggled to make this kind of an impact at the box office or anywhere near this. And I think that this will be exactly the kind of headwind that Marvel was hoping to have going into Doomsday. Whether that has this knock-on effect, I don't know. Because none of us saw this coming to this degree simply because the audience has not been there for superhero movies in the last year and a half. They have not been turning out. Now, they will turn out for Spider-Man. We know that now. Does that mean they turn out for everybody else? That's still a question.
Yeah, right. It's an interesting one. So to put it into context.
Contrutext?
Thank you. This made more money in its opening weekend than James Gunn's Superman and Supergirl combined. More than Thor Ragnarok. More than the first Doctor Strange. More than Spider-Man Homecoming. Mm. So it's kind of wild that this is happening. But Spider-Man, the Spider-Man movies and the MCU have been improving upon the other. Not exponentially, that would be insane, but Far From Home made more than Homecoming. No Way Home made more than Far From Home. And now this is, unless something goes catastrophically wrong in the next 2 weeks, it's going to make way more money than No Way Home. Which is interesting because that film had the big bump of, I don't want to spoil a 5-year-old movie here, but the other Spider-Man, it was also pandemic-y. So maybe the fact that it made $1.9 billion in a pandemic is extraordinary, and who knows how much money they left on the table by having it open in a pandemic. It wasn't their fault. Obviously, it wasn't in their control to do so. So this is so fascinating. There's so many ways to read this. I think there's absolutely a world in which this is the higher grossing of the two. Because we've been saying for a long, long time, is the desire for Doomsday as great as it was for Infinity War and Endgame. Equally, you could argue that this movie shows that there is the desire there. And I've seen little things. There was the Russo brothers posted something on Instagram. It was a Spider-Man opening night audience going Endgame level nuts for the Doomsday trailer. So whenever Thor appears, they went nuts. And whenever Steve appears, they went nutser. So I think there's also a universe. This is me sitting on the fence. There's also a universe in which Doomsday rides that wind and gets to a higher number than Spidey. But is it going to outgross? Is it going to have a bigger opening weekend? Is it going to? I mean, it's the Avengers. And Avengers is so far at the box office a bigger deal than Spider-Man. So
yeah,
it's very, very interesting.
I do feel like though, right, let's use a really unscientific method. Like how many Spider-Man t-shirts and hats do you see on a daily basis versus how many other Avengers hats and t-shirts do you see on a daily basis? Because I think Spider-Man, the iconography and the sort of name recognition, if you like, of that are head and shoulders above every single other hero in Doomsday. The other thing is there may be a generational shift happening. There was some chat about this online that, you know, Gen Z, if you like, embraces Spider-Man to a degree that they don't embrace the Avengers. And I think, you know, it is 7 years since the last Avengers movie. Mm. That is a whole sort of generation away. In movie terms, you know, Walt Disney used to re-release his films every 7 years because there'd be a whole new generation of kids coming up. It feels like that sort of generation has passed. We're now talking about, you know, Thor, Captain America, they're guys in their 40s. They're not necessarily Gen Z. Tom and Zendaya, that's Gen Z.
I'm not sure that would stand up in a court. But
the other thing is, like, you've got to remember the last two Avengers movies that did gross more. First of all, those were heavily featured Spider-Man. He was there certainly in the trailers for Infinity War, and everybody was waiting to see what happened to him in Endgame. I feel like he's kind of baked into those.
I don't think he's responsible. I know what you're saying, but I think his 5-minute cameo at the end of Endgame is not necessarily the driver.
No,
of
I'm not saying it's the driver, but I'm saying people knew he'd be in it at some point. That was a thing. And by Endgame, they were locked in. Like, that was Infinity War did its job. Everybody was locked in for Endgame. It wasn't even a question. If you saw Infinity War, you were 100% going back to the cinema for Endgame. And if you didn't, I'm sorry, I don't know what happened in your life, but it must have been bad. Like, you know, you were just going back for that. I think the work had been done by that point.
I think there's absolutely a world in which in Spider-Man Brand New Day ends up with 2.3 billion or something like that, and Avengers Doomsday has to make do with a paltry 1.6. But equally, I can see it being galvanized. And honestly, the panel, the Hall H panel coverage at from Comic-Con seemed to really, really capture people's imaginations. The trailer did incredibly well also. So I think it's been an interesting marketing campaign for Doomsday, but maybe they're timing a run to perfection and maybe this helps. So I'm honestly, I can't call it. I think we've talked in the past about how we feel like the potential for Doomsday to gross less than Infinity War and Endgame is pretty high, given everything that's happened with the MCU over the last few years. But this opening weekend and the reaction to Brand New Day makes me think that maybe we've been underestimating Doomsday, and that maybe it could be another 2.2 billion plus grosser.
Could be.
Yeah, you never write off the Avengers. You know, they're like any big sort of team-up movie. Feels like it's eventizing somehow. I think we're still a few months out and people are going to be hyped come December. I do think, though, the shine has come off a little bit, even with this huge Spidey bump. You know, the last Avengers movies did not have a handful of flops, or I say flops, you know, like $400 million flops. It flop in within this world. The sort of run up to it has felt a little bit shakier than previous Avengers movies. And so I wonder if, you know, you need that momentum, you need that sort of snowball, and you need to bring people along with it. And I don't know that this Avengers quite has the same momentum, and also doesn't maybe have the same sort of clarity of purpose that a Thanos had. You know, I just don't quite see it being as big, but who knows,
we shall see. But there you go. I think we've spent enough time, sadly. There's one more question. Maybe we can do it next week. Someone said that The Odyssey is Christopher Nolan's 13th film. Can we name a better 13th film in a director's resume? And that might take too long.
I'd have to go away and look at IMDb.
Yeah,
precisely, that's the thing. It would take too long. We'd have to do too much research. There'd be too much dead air as people scrolled through the IMDb, but we'll do it next week.
Will we?
We will do it next week. All right. Shall we have a little break?
Sure.
In which we don't actually take a break. We just go straight into the next section, but it'll be a break for you, the listener, if you choose it to be so. If you're listening to this on Empire Plus, of course, it does not have to be a break. You can just barrel straight through. If you are not listening to this on Empire Plus, you may be about to hear some adverts, and that constitutes a break. Here it is. See you in a second. Bye-bye. Okie dokie, folks. We are back. We are back, back, back. And it's time to talk about movie news. But first, before we do so, today, as we're recording this, is Wednesday, the 5th of August. In pretty much 1 month, in a few weeks anyway, also on the 5th of the month, the 5th of September, that is, we will be having our live show, our next live show, our next incredible Empire Podcast live show at King's Place in London. Very exciting, part of the London Podcast Festival. We do it every year. If you come along to those shows, you'll know that they are a ton of fun. And if you don't come to those shows, well, here I am to tell you that they are a ton of fun. Hellspell, is that right?
Ton of fun.
John, you've been to live shows, haven't you?
Sure.
Yeah, ours specifically. Are they good?
Yes, they are good.
Fantastic.
They are good. I like them.
Fucking hell, John. but I said with feeling.
They are really good.
They are really good, says John Nugent. So there we go. Kingsplace.co.uk. Kingsplace.co.uk to pick up tickets. Tickets are still on sale for that. But it's going to be a lot of fun. Me and Helen. John, you going to come along to that one?
Sure.
Okay, you got my cold.
I'm losing my voice.
Helen, we're both losing our voices.
Great.
It may be up to you to steer the ship home.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. Okay, so kingsplace.co.uk. Pick up your tickets. Come and see us live. It'll be fun. Also fun were things that happened in the world of movie news this week, weren't they, Helen O'Hara?
I mean, honestly, as the host of the Bah Humbug Christmas Movies podcast, the most exciting thing that happened this week by a country mile is the new trailer for Violent Night 2. This is the sort of, you know, Father Christmas the movie Die Hard crossover where Santa Claus is the John McClane character taking out bad guys and terrorists, because it turns out he was kind of a Viking before he became like Santa Claus. He's played by David Harbour, and he's back. So last time it was a very self-contained thing. Basically, one rich family were under siege from some ne'er-do-wells, and Santa had to take them out to protect a small angelic child caught up in the middle of all this.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
This time it seems to be a bit bigger. So the idea is that after that, he got a taste for not just bringing presents to the nice, but also punishing the naughty. And in so doing, he himself has landed on the naughty list and lost his powers. So he has to, wouldn't you know it, rediscover the true meaning of Christmas. I cannot tell you how many films I have watched about rediscovering the true meaning of Christmas. It must be the most easily undiscovered thing in the world. Maybe this is the undiscovered country that Captain Kirk and Hamlet were looking for. I genuinely, okay, sure. It looks stupid. It looks, if anything, more stupid than the first one, but I'm kind of here for it.
It looks like the greatest movie ever made.
I'm 100% here for it, but like, I'm just explaining that my bar for Christmas movies is a different bar to my bar for normal movies.
Your bar humbug, if you will.
My bar humbug, yes.
So Helen hosts a Christmas movie podcast, in case you don't know, called, what's it called?
Bah Humbug.
You fell into my cunningly laid trap. Bah Humbug. And this must be, because I know the sort of fucking unwatchable shit that you have to wade through for that podcast.
I mean, sometimes,
and so,
yeah.
A movie like this.
Oh, it's a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, you must have put it on your Christmas list, right?
Oh, it's like a 100%. It's like a peppermint scented, dreamy waft of goodness. I'm super here for it. And look, this year I also have to watch Ebenezer, don't forget.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, yeesh. this is particularly necessary and needed.
Hey, Ebenezer might be good.
It could be good. Every day is literally Christmas Eve.
Yep.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. John, were you taken by this Christmassy version of Taken?
Yeah, sure. I have to confess, I never saw the first film, but it looks fun. It's like very, very bad Santa. Is that the idea?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but like he's doing it in a good cause, at least in the first one, yeah.
Okay, but he does kill people.
He 100% kills people. And he is, to be fair, even in the first one, drunk and slightly, you know, cynical about how people are losing the true meaning of Christmas. So he starts off the first film quite embittered that other people don't believe in Christmas, and now it seems like he's one of them. So that's going to be interesting, I guess. I don't think they'll get that deep, if I'm honest.
Speaking of getting deep, Mrs. Claus is in this as well.
Oh no, Chris.
Was that a bad segue?
That was terrible.
Oh no.
Yes, Kristen Bell is introduced this time as Mrs. Claus.
A Christmas bell.
Oh, wow. Every time a bell rings.
Oh, my God. Every time a bell kills a bad guy.
And she does.
She does,
yeah. Fair play to her, yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Is she the first Mrs. Claus since Goldie Hawn in The Christmas Chronicles 2?
I mean, almost certainly not if you include all the Hallmark channels and Netflixes and all the rest. But yeah, in terms of big screen clauses, she's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
Oh, my. It looks good. I mean, I must confess, don't like to say this in front of the host of Bah Humbug. Sorry, Bar Humbug. But wow. Hey, that could be your next one.
Bar Humbug?
Law movies.
Oh. I object.
Yeah.
That's overruled. A great idea.
So I also have not seen the first Violent Night. I know it's right up my boulevard, right?
It is
right?
So your boulevard.
But I haven't seen it. But this trailer looked like a lot of fun.
Okay.
And it's the same director, isn't it? Tommy Fricola?
Yeah.
And take it from me, guys, if you see only one movie this December starring David Harbour as a Red Guardian, then perhaps it should be Violent Night too. I can't think of any others.
I can't think of a single one.
No, nope, not a single one. So it looks good to me.
Which film do you think will win the box office wars?
Well, it depends on if Helen goes to see it a billion times, then maybe it'll be Violent Night too. But we shall see. Was there another trailer you wanted to talk about?
Yes, we also watched this week Your Mother, Your Mother, Your Mother. Now, I haven't just developed some kind of brain freeze. That is the name of the film. This is the Mahershala Ali action movie where he plays a deeply religious hitman. I immediately have notes. Who is left trying to, you know, carry out his hits, but also look after his three children who he is now solely responsible for following the tragic death of his wife.
Oh, no.
So he's literally trying to get, you know, milk for the baby at the same time as, like, smoking fools, except not smoking fools because he uses a blade. This is a blade-led movie for Mahershala Ali.
Wow, he's finally getting to make his Blade movie?
That's it.
With Bassam Tariq, who was the director assigned to the Blade movie for Marvel, which will be made any second now, right?
I've got bad news for you about that, Chris.
Oh, no. Yeah, because Mahershala Ali has been doing interviews, I think, promoting this or maybe something else, I'm not sure, because this is now for a couple of months. But he's been saying that, as far as he's concerned, Blade is no longer happening at Marvel Studios. And if they'd wanted to make the movie, they would have made the movie. Now, that seems like a fairly unequivocal calling out. But perhaps they didn't want to make a bad movie, I'm guessing. And no one say anything. No one say anything. Do not say Quantumania. You fucking say Quantumania, I will hit you with a key light now.
I was only thinking it. I didn't.
Don't you even. It's the, my God.
I think maybe the bigger issue was just how does Blade fit into this world that they have at the moment? And they couldn't figure out the way to make that sort of canon work, I guess.
I mean, there's all sorts of rumors flying around about what happened with that film. It got close. It got real close. It had a release date. It was in pre-production. People were cast. Sets were built, and then it just went away.
I feel very sad about this. Mahershala Ali is, you know, he's a two-time Oscar winner. Like, the fact you can't get one of the best actors working in Hollywood today to lead your movie and just find a way through is really sad. But I'm very interested in this Your Mother, Your Mother, Your Mother, which seems like it's almost, I don't know, they're sort of exercising their demons. You know, this is a film that could only have been made because they were both available because they weren't working on Blade. Mm-hmm. And it does seem quite Blade-y. There are Blades in it. It feels like this is maybe them sort of like dealing with the trauma of that fallout somehow.
Mm, I think so too.
It's very interesting.
Did we also see, before we move entirely away from Marvel, eventually, I guess, the news that Samara Weaving is reportedly going to be playing Emma Frost. Now, this is all quite speculation-y, I think, at the moment, quite unconfirmed-y. But I have to say, I'm into it. I feel it. I feel like, first of all, you need two things, right, to be Emma Frost. Maybe three. You need to be smoking hot. She's got that on lock, right? You need to be a little bit funny, I think, ideally.
Yep.
Not all the ones on screen have been, but in the comics, she's often very funny. And you need to be convincingly mean. And Samara Weaving, while I'm sure she's a delightful human in real life, can play mean really well and can play kind of disdainful really well. And I'm super into that as a piece of casting. That feels right to me and a really good sort of place to start from. I don't know if I'd start my Return of the X-Men with Emma Frost. She's not core X-Men to me, but she has done some really interesting stuff. So I'm kind of interested to see where they take that.
I never read X-Men comics, so I don't know this character except for her appearance in X-Men First Class.
Played by January Jones.
So is it like that?
I mean, kind of, yes. So she is smoking hot and super psychic. Like, that's kind of what you need to know.
She's super psychic.
I mean, she is. She's very psychic. Like, she is very powerful as psychics go. Maybe not quite like Charles Xavier, but pretty close. In some of the comics, she also has this diamond mutation, which they did with her in those movies, which to me is a little bit silly, but
diamonds
fine,
are
whatever.
A girl's best friend.
Well, that's clearly where they started and ended that thought process, let's be honest. But anyway, she also wears a bikini a lot.
Does she? I haven't noticed.
And has it all hanging out, but everything that she has hanging out is, as I said, smoking hot.
Emma Frost, I think, is famously one of the most bosomy comic book characters.
Okay. You were reading them for the articles, these comics.
I read them for the thought bubbles. That's what I was reading for. This is really interesting casting. Because we don't know what the makeup of this X-Men team is. Mm. The Jake Schreier, the director of Thunderbolts, is directing the X-Men movie, which hasn't been given a date yet. But it feels to me like it wouldn't be wide of the mark to say 2028. So Marvel are beginning to slowly rule out their post-Secret Wars revitalization resetting of the MCU. Secret Wars is next after Doomsday. That's in 2027, December 2027. We have Black Panther 3 coming December 2028. We know there's a Ghost Rider movie at some point in 2028 as well. It wouldn't surprise me if Ghost Rider was, say, July and X-Men was May. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it was that. And the fact that they're casting right now, clearly they weren't ready to announce the cast of X-Men at Comic-Con, which I thought there was an outside chance that they might do that. They might go, please welcome your new X-Men. But they haven't quite done that. If Emma Frost is is an X-Man in this, because she might not be. She started off as a baddie and then she became a goodie. She becomes involved with Cyclops and that kind of helps swing her towards the light side. There could be a lot of powerful telepaths in this movie. Mm. Not your most inherently cinematic power, I would say. So I'd be fascinated to see what the makeup of this team is, whether it's Cyclops, Jean Grey, the kind of traditional X-Men, or whether they'll throw Beast, Iceman, Angel, or whether they'll throw a Wolverine curveball in there.
I think they might hold off on Wolverine a little bit.
You think?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. A lot remains to be seen, but if Samara Weaving is Emma Frost, it's pretty much perfect casting. Mm. I wonder if she asked her uncle, Hugo Weaving, aka the Red Skull, for advice. She addresses the large portrait of him that she has in her hallway.
She does?
Yeah. Okay. And she goes, Uncle, would you recommend I work for Marvel in the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Did you have a good time in that movie, the Captain America, the First Avenger? And the portrait spins around at great speed and goes, no! Just give me a sign. Any sign. I'll be waiting. So could be that.
Okay.
Kudos to the man with two brains for that joke.
Yeah.
Works in an audio format anyway. Looking forward to that. That'll be fun. Great. Anything else?
There are a couple of quick things that won't detain us long. I'm excited that Oded Fehr is returning to
the
Mummy.
Oh my God! And no, so am I!
Are you?
Oded Fehr!
Yeah?
He's back!
Also, I am excited. I think this is cool. They're doing a Welsh dub of Star Wars.
Whoa. Sorry. We need to go back.
Okay.
We need to go back to The Mummy.
All right. So this is the Radio Silence.
Yes.
Legacy sequel to The Mummy.
Yes. It's incredibly Samara Weaving's not in this movie.
It's getting the whole team back together. We've got Brendan Fraser. We've got Rachel Weisz, John Hannah. We now have Oded Fehr, that's like the core four, if you will, of the old team.
The core four.
You're damn right it is.
Is Arnold Vosloo back as Imhotep?
I don't know that that's been announced.
Oh, yeah. Imhotep. But there's another bit of casting.
There is.
You weren't getting to it. You welled on banging on about fucking Star Wars in Welsh.
Okay, well, Numan Akar is joining the cast, but also Michael Johnston from Obsession.
Yes. Again, that's not the casting I was talking about, but it's
which
good
one
casting.
What are you talking about?
You don't know this casting?
Maybe not.
All right. Well, it's exciting because the Michael Johnston thing is very interesting. So the casting that Helen overlooked and in fact has just discovered in real time, if you heard the intake of breath, is a Kevin J. O'Connor is coming back for The Mummy 4 or / 3 because I think they're going to ignore The Mummy 3. Now, this
I've
is interesting because his character, Benny, did he die in the first movie?
Mm. Yeah, well, he seemed to. I don't think we'd like literally saw bones, but he seemed to be about to get squished yes. in a tomb.
That's the one thing we always need. We need proof of death in movies. We need people to hold up the bones of the person who's died. Mean,
literally, unless someone is beheaded, they're pretty much like liable to come back. I mean, they cut your man...
What if their head, what if you cut someone's head off, right?
Right, right.
And their head flew through the air.
Yeah.
And landed back exactly
on their neck.
Well, yes, but also, what if, and I realize that this is a pretty, pretty high odds.
Yeah.
What if their head landed in someone else's body?
That had just been beheaded.
Who had just been beheaded, and all their veins and... tendons fused.
I'm seeing something a little bit Mars Attacks-y.
I think so.
Yeah. I don't think that's likely though, Chris. I'm not a medical doctor, but I think they would still die.
Okay.
But like when people bring back, for example, Darth Maul, who got literally chopped in half, and like nobody has a problem with that.
Yeah.
I feel like all bets are off. Unless you see their body chopped into small pieces, like they might come back. And especially with something like The Mummy, which is all about bringing the dead back
yes,
to life.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's built in.
The whole series is he died and he got better kind of thing.
Yes.
It's he died and he got better, the movie.
Yeah. You excited about this, John? You excited about The Mummy 4?
Yeah. Oh, come on. It's all our favorite gals and guys. Do it up to adventures.
It's exciting.
Honestly, I love The Mummy.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about? Oh, what was this Welsh Star Wars business?
They're doing a Welsh dub of Star Wars with Matthew Rhys and Risa Fans. Matthew Rhys fans are going to be voicing some of the voices in the Welsh dub of Star Wars.
Ijuba. And where will this be shown?
I mean,
Wales.
I'm guessing.
Wales.
Wales, most likely. I think this is because Lucasfilm's new co-president, Lynwen Brennan, is... Welsh is from,
no way
from
with a name
like that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's great. I was actually born in Wales. I am technically I know I don't sound it, but I am.
You
can
play football
Welsh.
For Wales.
I could play football for Wales.
Do you have Welsh parents?
No.
Okay.
So explain the story.
I grew up on the border of Wales. I grew up in England, but right over the other side of the border.
John's story is falling apart.
My grandparents had a farm in Wales. They lived in Wales.
Oh, okay.
I have little patches of Welsh in my family tree, but I'm...
Your Welsh accent there was sublime.
Did you see there was also a Disney animator who did a sign language reanimation of several Disney songs?
Amazing.
A couple of years ago, I think now? They didn't make a big deal of it at the time, and then I heard about it quite recently.
That's
and
really cool.
It's beautiful, and you kind of wish they would do that more. I think it's a wonderful thing to do. The problem is, of course, they'd obviously have to do different kinds of sign language as well, but it'd be cool.
Yeah, very cool. All right, should we have a guest?
Let's
do it. Shall we have Taika Waititi?
Ooh.
Yes.
Sure.
Because, incredibly, Hunt for the Wilder People is 10 years old.
Whoa.
That's
crazy.
Yeah. How has that been allowed to happen?
Mm.
It's wild. This is Taika Waititi's 2016 movie. I'm going to say it's not quite the movie that put him on the map because, he was a filmmaker of note, a New Zealand filmmaker of note before that with things like Boy and Eagle vs. Shark and, of course, What We Do in the Shadows. But I think it's the movie that is the most Taika Waititi. I think it's fair to say, Hell's Bells, you adore this movie. It's one of your favorites of all time,
Yeah, it is actually. I think it's his masterpiece so far.
Even more than Thor, Love and Thunder?
I thought you were going to say Thor Ragnarok and at least make me think about it, but no.
No. Didn't do that.
No.
But a tremendous, tremendous movie, of course, starring the late, great Sam Neill as Heck, who is a bushman who goes on the run with, I guess is his young foster child.
Technically a bad egg.
Ricky Baker, played by Julian Dennison, and they go on the run in the New Zealand bush. And many, many wonderful, whimsical, and witty and madcap things happen to them along the way. It's a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous movie. It's being re-released this week in the cinemas around the country. So go and see Hunt for the Wilder People, and it's coming out on pristine Blu-ray and whatnot. And next week, as of the 14th, so very, very exciting. And Taika was in London last week, but he leapt onto Zoom and had a chat with me about a great many things. Obviously, we talked about the recent loss of the great Sam Neill, and Taika dealt with that in a very, very Taika way.
Oh, gosh.
So this is a... it's always a blast talking to Taika Waititi. This was a funny, irreverent, tangential conversation about a great many things. And I tried manfully to get him to talk about Hunt for the Wilder People at some point. And you know what? I think I succeeded from time to time. Here we go, Taika Waititi. Enjoy. Taika Waititi, welcome to the Emperor Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm very, very good. I'm very, very good indeed. Obviously excited to be talking to you about Hunt for the Wilder People, but under very, very sad circumstances, because obviously we've lost Sam.
What?
Are you? Is this how you're learning
what?
With it?
This is news to me. No, it is sad, and it's very strange because it's pretty fresh, and it's not like I'm not going to say, like, oh, I expect him to call me any second, but it is weird that I can't just text someone like you used to, you know. And you start thinking about the finality of it, you're like, oh, that's all gone. And it's just a weird thing to know that something, you can't get something back. I don't have any regrets, or I wish you should have said something or any of that stuff. It's just more like, it's just a weird thing. I'm like, I can't text that person, I can't call them, I won't see them.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible.
And I had a role for him too for the next film.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'll play it now.
When was the last time you saw him? Because we did a little virtual Zoom reunion with you guys.
Yes. Yes.
Was that the last time you saw him?
That would have been it on that Zoom. And then I saw him in Auckland. We did a sort of 10-year thing earlier this year. We had a big reunion there. And then before that was at Jurassic Park that you love so much, Chris, that Jurassic Park ad that I did for the Super Bowl, where we got him and Laura Dern and Jeff Goldblum together to advertise internet.
I wasn't aware. It didn't terrify me in any way, shape, or form. So
yeah, get onto the internet, man. It's a world of possibilities.
It certainly is. But, you know, I think it's really fascinating, you know, like the idea that we're talking about Wilder People 10 years on, you know, because this feels like a movie that is, strangely, a movie that came out yesterday, but also a movie that's been around a lot longer than 10 years. Does it feel like that to you?
It does. My idea of how time passes is very different now. I don't know, even know what 10 years ago means. But the book has been around since, what, the 60s? I started trying to adapt that in around 2004, I think, 2003, 2004. It's a really long time ago. And so I spent about 2 years developing that. You probably know this. I think I've talked about this. And that version of the script was before I sort of had found my voice, and I thought I was going to be a really dramatic artsy filmmaker. And Sam's character died in the end, and it was like hellish. There was no hope at the end, and I was like, this is what people want to see. I'm going to go to Cannes. if I just kill this kid, I'll get into Cannes. So that never happened. And so and then I just put that aside. I was like, oh, this is not really me. Then we made three movies, yep. And sort of figured out how I spoke in film and like what my voice was, and then came back to it and I was like, this makes perfect sense. This should be a comedy, but also have some meaning and some depth to it, and it should be about this and this and this. And so I'm glad I took the time to wait. I think time always helps with everything I've ever made. All my films have taken so long to make, but What We Do in the Shadows, I think we wrote for 7 years.
Was it just like one page a day for 7 years, or
one page? It was like one page a month, actually, with me and Jermaine. We're notoriously slow, just grunting at each other in cafes. Maybe they made a werewolf. We're trying to write werewolves at the moment, and we haven't written a single page, and we've been officially writing for about 6 months.
So, what do you guys do when you get together to write?
Everyone who's listening to this or reading this will be dead by the time it comes out. Is that almost a threat?
By the way, that is a threat.
No one's allowed to see it unless they're dead.
So, because this has been in the works, Taika, for a long, long time, you've been promising this movie. Well, maybe not promising.
I know, and you know what? Now I've got kids, I know the value of a promise and like how, you know, you shouldn't just promise things willy-nilly and then and then draw it out for years.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to promise anything. In fact, I'm going to reverse that. Werewolves is never coming out. Now, here's the catch. When it does come out, you're going to be like, what?
I'll surprise. Play this back to you. I'll play this clip to you.
Well, that'll be for a different interview, won't it? Promoting a different thing.
It would be. Although what I'll do is, instead of playing the clip from this interview to you during that interview, I'll just play this entire interview.
You won't, because you'll be dead.
Fuck. I haven't thought this through.
So will I.
Shit. This could be an amazing amazing conversation between, what, our souls?
They will play this later on in the future. Wow, how right they were. They didn't know it.
So you and Jermaine, basically, you're getting together to write this movie, but you think that what's the point? Because everyone's going to be dead. So then you don't write the movie. Is that essentially what happens?
This is how a film works. You talk about things forever and then you don't do them. If you've spent any time in Hollywood, that's how the system works.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you've been attached to a number of things over the years. There's been a Star Wars.
Yeah, and what happened to them? Where are they?
What happened to
them? Exactly. It's best actually to just shut your mouth and never talk about anything you're doing, because it's like we're all just doomed to jinx everything by.
Yeah. With that in mind, do you regret saying 5 minutes ago that you're writing werewolves?
Oh, yeah, I do. Because you're going to only use that bit and then people are going to be like excited.
Maybe like hot Empire podcast scoop.
The 20 vampire fans that are left in the world.
That is not true. That film was a huge hit. And my understanding is a television show.
No, millions of people saw the film, or if 20 people saw it millions of times.
I think that might be it. The 20 What We Do in the Shadows fans would be overjoyed by this news.
Yeah.
But what is your process then when you get together with Jermaine to write this? What are you doing?
It literally is just us sitting around and grunting and just talking and just sort of suggesting things and then sitting in silence for a bit. It's like two very spectrum-y dudes sitting around trying to just figure out a story that should be so simple, but somehow we always figure out a way to make it way too complicated.
Is that the most important thing for you though, as you know, as writers, even if because
yeah, you've
comedies.
Got to go through it. You've got to kick that can down the alley, as they say, or go down the. I don't know what the sayings are. I'll make up one. Go down the cul-de-sac, knock on every door.
That's right. That's
in the wrong cul-de-sac. But you've got to. That's why, like the first film, we shot so much footage. I think 160 hours. And we had to get that down to 90 minutes. And that was a hard job. We had to overshoot all of that stuff so that we could sort of really figure out. And we should have shot it basically like a documentary, you know, like most mockumentaries, they have a script and they just are very precise. We shot it where we had way too much stuff. And then we thought, okay, now we'll find the story in the edit, just like a real documentary. And I hated that. Because it took 2 years to edit.
Well, I guess also something like that, you're being confronted with hundreds of hours of footage. That's a long time in itself, just pouring through that.
Just, yeah, of you and your best friend dressed as vampires on wires floating around a house. No idea what the story's about.
Listen, I'm not implying that for a second that any of the stuff you shot didn't work, but were you ever confronted with stuff that didn't work? And then suddenly you're going, oh, God.
Yeah, there's 159 hours of stuff that didn't work. Promise we had to watch it all.
And the film is the only stuff that worked.
Yeah,
just
basically. We finished the film. We premiered it at Sundance. And in the premiere, we were trying to sell it. We had buyers from all over Hollywood in the screening, and we were watching it. It's the first time I'd seen it with like a proper audience who weren't our friends. And Jermaine leaned over and he goes, we've still got a lot of work to do. And we ended up telling, we're on stage and Jermaine goes, basically it's like, it's not really for sale. And basically we just pulled it and went back home and kept working on it for another 6 months.
Taika, I've got to let you go in about 5 minutes, and I realize we've spoken mainly about what we do in the shadows. So when you started, you came back to Wilder People after what we do in the shadows. Did you look back at that screenplay that you'd written when you were a tortured serious artist in waiting?
I knew it was bad, but I did scanned through it.
Did any of it survive?
No, it did a page one rewrite.
Oh, wow.
I read it and I thought something might survive when I write it from scratch, but it just didn't. None of it seemed to work.
So in terms of the tone of the film, though, was that something that you, was that there in the script?
It didn't even have that tone, the original script. It was sad. There were a few jokes here and there, but it just didn't have that sense of adventure or fun or whimsy. People like to use that word, that I love to use describing my films. And I just had this feeling that, it's okay to make a film that was like that sort of, that just fell into a bit more of a genre feel, like, like a chase film, and like having that kind of, this one villain who was the Paula character who didn't exist in the book or in any other version of the script I'd written. I thought, oh, let's have this woman who's, chasing this kid for no reason at all. And she's just a social worker. She has no power to actually do it. But this is her vendetta and this is her mission. And that just made it more fun. And so I knew, like, underneath it all, that, there's some serious issues with, like, the foster care system, and not just in New Zealand, in the world, and how children are treated. They're passed around these families like without much care, and they get lost in the system a lot. And I wanted that to be the sort of underlying thing, and not that for that not to be like the big message, but just the way that, children and also adults can get lost in the system and forgotten about. And, when people live on the margins of society, they, it's ironic because, like, we get born and we get our feet stamped and we say you're part of society now, but if you sort of choose to leave, if you don't want to go off and have an adventure or live in the book, if you don't want to take part in society, you're labeled a radical and crazy, and and people really object to that behavior wanting to do your own thing, and which is really sad for human beings.
How dare you
to not have any freedom. And so I just like the idea of, like, underneath that all, it's just about people who who wanted to a bit of freedom to just be who they were, and then have fun along the way, because that's always been my thing, is to try and bring audiences in with entertainment.
Were you writing it with Sam in mind?
I wasn't writing with Sam in mind, or Julian, or anyone. I just was picturing these characters, and then I met Julian on a commercial and instantly knew he was the one that they should play it. So I didn't audition them, I just gave him the role. And then Sam, and then when I started thinking about casting, Sam's name popped up, and he was basically the first choice, because I just thought he's, New Zealand royalty, and he just felt perfect, and he was.
What was that commercial you did with Julian, by the way?
It was a anti-drug driving PSA, because in New Zealand we not only do we have to stamp down. What is the saying?
I think you say you kick the can, then you stamp down on it.
You stamp down on drink driving. We also have to do PSAs for drug driving, for people getting stoned and trying to drive their cars. But we don't have crazy big, they don't have very big, messy accidents. They have like slow sort of, they drive too slow is like one of the problems, one of the big issues. People get stoned and they drive too slow. And sometimes they like ruin their rims on the curb or bump into trees. But that's a big deal. That's a big deal, and so we need to stop that. We also have PSAs for don't drink and fry, which is a real ad where it's you don't get drunk and come home and fry food, because people have been burning their houses down. So that's a big thing. I'm not lying. Don't drink and fry.
Look me in the virtual eye and tell me that's definitely real.
It's absolutely true, and you can look it up. Don't drink and fry commercials. New Zealand has got a plethora of incredibly weird PSA type ads. There was one from, like, I think the early 80s, where a guy drove his car outside a store. He went inside and there was like a clock wipe, and he comes out of the store and his car's gone, and the PSA was, don't leave your keys in the car. That was it. It's a quaint country, but it's charming.
Well, listen, I'm going to Google that. I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to Google that. That's your gift to me. Here's my gift to you in terms of PSAs. Have you ever seen, this is the thing I'm going to leave you with, in Northern Ireland, where I'm from, we also have drink driving PSAs.
God, you're not going to go on about bloody all the stuff, are you?
Joking. No, no, it's got nothing to do with the stuff.
I'm joking.
I will say that these are PSAs from a country that is inured to violence because these things are spectacularly gory and incredibly violent. And you should Google them or YouTube them immediately after this because it'll fuck your shit up.
The Northern Irish PSAs, that's what we look for. Before we go, I've downloaded a vocabulary app. And I'm just going to test you on one on a word. I'm just going to scrolling through. Let's find one.
Okay.
Oh, this is how I describe myself. Oh, you're going to know this. Aphorist.
Aphorist.
I don't even care. You know what? This is over. Contumacious.
Which one?
Contumacious.
Do you want me to spell it or do you want me to define it?
Contumacious.
Define. That's how I would have spelled it, but I don't know what it means.
Stubbornly disobedient, rebellious. That's also how I describe myself. I'm contumacious. Boom. Love to see you, mate.
Absolutely. And good luck writing werewolves. I can see why it's taking so long.
Screw you.
See ya. All right, that was Taika Waititi, director of Hunt for the Wilder People. His new movie, Clara and the Sun, is coming out relatively soon. Mm-hmm. Might be a player in the Oscar race. You never know. Hell's Bells, it's a reviews section of the show.
Sure is.
Obviously, this is a 10-year-old film. We don't tend to talk about reissues and re-releases on the podcast, but are we going to make an exception in the case of Hunt for the Wilder People?
Hooray! Honestly, I just love it. I think it's maybe still my top film of the last 10 years. It's definitely up there. It is a beautiful story about sort of found family and two very lost people kind of finding their way back by being lost, if that makes sense. Ricky Baker, the Julian Dennison character, and Heck, the Sam Neill character, both of them are old-timers, but Ricky Baker in particular is one of the most indelible characters of the past couple of decades. I think he's magnificent. And Julian Dennison did an incredible job at the age of 12 playing him.
Yeah.
I also spoke to them recently for the magazine, and they all have rightly fond memories of it. And Sam Neill was the one who knew even as they were making it, he was like, this is going to be special. This is going to be, you know, embraced by people. People are going to take this to their hearts. And I think he was 100% correct. Because it's really funny. It's absolutely hilarious at times. There's a whole riff about Terminator 2 in the middle that's just one of the greatest sort of pop culture references of the past ever. But it's also just got so much heart to it and so much soul. And it's kind of got this melancholy undercurrent that keeps all the humor kind of grounded. And yeah, I love it. Love it to death.
Yeah, it has for
it
me.
Skunks.
Yes, well, it is for me, cinema. It has for me one of the best, I think, tonal transitions I've ever seen, which is there is a bit in the film, I won't give it away, but there is a scene of major and sudden grief in the movie. And then there's a hard cut to one of the most incompetent eulogies in cinema history, delivered by Taika Waititi himself as a bumbling priest. And just, I've always been in awe of what he does in those two simple cuts from something that rips your heart out to in the very next scene, something that makes you laugh yourself silly. And that, I think, is kind of an encapsulation of his entire career as a director. But anyway, 5 stars then for Hunt for the Wilder People. I don't know. Have you given it 5 stars? We're giving it 5 stars. Fuck it. 5 stars.
We did give it five stars. Yes. 10 years ago.
Amazing.
Anyway, much deserved.
So multiply that 5 stars by the 10 years. 50 stars then for Hunt for the Wilder People. But that's talk about movies that are out right now or over the next few days for you to see in the multiplexes and indeed on the sofaplexes. Shall we start with The Last House, which is on Netflix as of today and stars Greta Lee, Wagner Moura, and it's directed by Louis Leterrier. I don't know why I did that. And it's directed by Louis Leterrier. Hell's Bells?
Yeah.
Tell us about this movie.
This is an interesting one. So basically, Wagner Moura and Greta Lee are a married couple. They have two children. He gets back from an early morning fishing trip one morning. There's a storm brewing off the coast. I think they live in sort of Seattle area. And they're going about the business of getting the kids out to school and getting out to work and starting the day. And then the door won't open. And then the windows won't open. And then nothing in the house will let them out. And the rain falling outside seems to be causing this unnaturally. And they are basically trapped in their house. And over the days and weeks that follow, they have to start rationing food and they have to start figuring out how to survive in their house with nothing coming in and nothing going out, and what is happening and what has caused this. It seems to be connected to this unnatural rain that is sort of still falling most of the time. But what's causing the rain? Who's controlling this? Is it aliens? Is it a government conspiracy? Like, what's going on? So there's some really interesting stuff in here. At times I felt about this the same way I felt about the war between the land and the sea last year, which is that if you're going to adapt
Doctor Who thing.
If you're going to adapt John Wyndham's The Kraken Wakes, just adapt John Wyndham's The Kraken Wakes and don't like fuck about. But that said, that's me just like feeling like there's a better version of this story out there. But there is something interesting in this. And to the film's credit, I think it tries to grapple with that. Like, this is not just a film about, this is an alien invasion and they're hunting us down. There's quite a lot of an interesting, you know, middle section about, okay, so how do you survive just with what you have in your house? What can you do? What are the survival techniques? What hope do you have? You know, how do you keep your children alive? Like, how are you going to manage this? And so I find all of that really quite interesting and relatively fresh and relatively new. I hadn't seen that particular thing kind of done in this way before. And then it kind of remembers that it's a Louis Leterrier film and it starts sort of, you know, trying to get into a bit more silly stuff. I would definitely not survive this scenario. Like, I am, like, they can do things that in a house that I can't do in a flat. It helps that Wagner Moura's character is a bit of a like mechanical genius and can come up with all these
what
kind
are the odds?
Of Rube Goldbergian devices that will you know, enable them to kind of trap animals and things like that. It's sometimes a bit silly, but I was at least interested in it in a way that I'm not by, you know, all streaming films of this nature. So I thought it attempted some stuff and it gets some points for that, but I didn't think the whole last act was entirely successful.
No, that's very fair. I think, you know, there's some interesting stuff about, like, it reminded me a little bit of the first lockdown, you know. It's sort of this, you know, we're forced into a confined space against our will by these bigger outside forces, and you can actually find some joy in that. And there's some actually really lovely played sort of, you know, wholesome family activities. They learn the value of physical media, you know, like it's a really lovely, there's some very nice montages where they get to know DVDs and vinyl and board games. And I appreciated that a lot. And, you know, Wagner Moura and Greta Lee are very, very good actors they're very good company. You know, we've seen them do slightly more subtle work in things like Past Lives and The Secret Agent. This, I would say, is not subtle. it's pretty sort of, you know, like dunderheaded in its plotting and its characterization. I mean, it's like you say, Helen, it's very daft. I kept, like, they talk about the rain a lot. There's sort of like strange rain that's happening outside. I kept thinking about Bowfinger and the chubby rain that they talk about in that film. It's very silly. I think the stuff in the third act where it goes a bit more CGI was just nonsense. But it's fine. It reminded me a lot of like Bird Box. It's kind of that sort of thing. They're trying to do a kind of Quiet Place, mysterious monster force. What would happen? What if kind of thing? It's trying to be a sort of quick and easy, like water cooler kind of film. And it, you know, it modestly achieves that. I don't think it's anything more than a 3-star.
No, but absolutely not.
But Yeah, it's fine.
All right, what are we officially giving it?
Well, I'm currently writing the review as we speak right now.
Really? During the podcast?
I've been doing it the whole time. it's a 3-star.
3 stars. Okay, yeah. 3 stars in for The Last House, which is on Netflix. There's another film, Hell's Bells, Love Me Tender.
Yeah, this is a French film starring Vicky Creeps playing a woman who was married for 20 years and had a small son, and then left her husband and is now and left her job and is now trying to reinvent herself, not as a corporate lawyer, but as a writer, and sort of discovering her identity as a bi woman after being married to this guy basically her entire sort of adult life.
Yeah.
And when she sort of comes out to her husband, their cozy shared custody arrangement and their easy relationship just disappears, and he starts getting very vengeful. He files for divorce, he files for sole custody, and she starts this fight to regain access to her beloved child, but also, you know, try and maintain her own sense of self that she has found, and sort of, you know, continue her own life. So it's quite an upsetting film a lot of the time. I definitely would not recommend this if you have been through a difficult divorce or a difficult family time yourself. It is really quite harsh that way. So this was written and directed by Anna Kaznev-Kombe, and is based on a novel. And I thought it was just well done, well put together, beautifully shot by Christy Baboul, nicely acted, but just it really is quite a lot emotionally. You know, this woman who is a really good, devoted mother, apart from obviously leaving her marriage and you know, breaking up the family, I guess, to that degree, but she is still devoted to her child, and she just suddenly is put in this position of completely losing access to him. So it is really kind of quite emotionally traumatic. So yeah, but good performances, well put together. And yeah, just one to avoid if you've been in that situation yourself, I think. I've spent the week basically warning friends about this. So
is that the opposite of what a film critic's meant to do? I don't know.
I think
it's a decent, well-made film.
It's a really
and
good
whatnot.
Film. But
like, do not see this film.
Look, I told all the friends that I warned about it. I said, look, this is a really good film, and you're the kind of person who might go see this. But just so you know, here's a content warning.
Yeah,
that's the situation.
Just keep repeating, it's only a movie, it's only a movie, it's only a movie. What would you give it?
A high 3, low 4. I think it's a really solid film. It's just, you know, it's not going to be for everyone.
Sounds good. All right, so pick one.
4.
4 stars in for Love Me Tender, but do not under any circumstances go see this movie.
No, I was only just recommending it
to certain people.
Yeah,
okay.
Specific people.
All right, okay. So there we go. All right, last film to review this week is the interestingly titled Nimrods, a Green Day comedy. John Nugent, please explain what that means.
Yes, well, it was originally titled New Year's Rev, but this is very much a Green Day film. It is produced by Green Day. It has a story by credit for Green Day, and it also stars Green Day. And it is sort of about Green Day. It's about 3 young men who are in a punk band, and they're big Green Day fans, and they're trying to not only get tickets to see Green Day, but they think they might have even got an opening slot at one of their gigs. And so they travel across the country to Los Angeles in attempts to play alongside their heroes. And it's I understand it's like loosely inspired by the Green Day story. It's sort of about or inspired by Green Day's sort of early years as a band in the 90s.
Yeah.
So a lot of the elements of the story came from their life is what I understand. And it's directed by
Lee Kirk,
who also directed a film with Green Day's lead singer, Billy.
You don't know anything about Green Day, do you, John?
I have heard of their one song.
You think they're Trey Cool?
They're Trey Cool. Very good.
John said, do you have the time to listen to me whine? their lead singer is Billy Joe Armstrong.
Billy Joe Armstrong. Okay. And he was in a film called Ordinary World in 2016, which was also directed by Lee Kirk. So there's a, you know, a relationship there with the band and the filmmaker. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of a coming of age film. It's kind of an ode to punk music and punk sort of ethos. I felt the formula of it a little bit. I felt like it was hitting a lot of familiar notes, you know. And I don't know that I totally got a deep well of character from the three leads, other than they love rock music and one of them has a dead dad. I wanted a little bit more than that. But it's very sweet. Mm. It's really sweet. I thought the cast are really engaging and fun.
Who are the cast, John?
The cast, it's a really good question.
I like to test your powers of observation.
The cast, of course, Mason Thames.
Which apparently is not pronounced Thames.
It's Thames, isn't it?
Like the river. It's either Thames. Thames or Thames.
We had this discussion when How to Train Your Dragon came out.
I think it's Thames.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he's really good in this. I liked him, but I kind of agree they're a little bit underwritten. I think it's Kyler Kaufman is the sort of goofy, slightly addled, green-haired one.
Green-haired guy, yeah.
And then Ryan Faust is the kind of straight-laced, oh, my mom won't approve of this kind of one.
Yeah.
You're right, that there could have been a little bit more to that and maybe more about, I think the problem is the relationships between them are being tested so much during the film that you don't get a lot of a sense of, do they like each other in the first place? Mm-hmm. You know, but they play together, I guess. And the music is pretty fun, actually. Yes. Their songs, not just like the Green Day stuff. And then, you know, you have a really good supporting cast. Like there's a tiny Sean Gunn bit. There's McKenna Grace turning up. Fred Armisen.
Your buddy
Chris is in it. And of course, also Green Day turn up playing themselves.
Yes.
I liked this a bit more than I expected to, but I did find it formulaic. I did think they could have done more maybe with the road trip kind of elements of the film. But I thought there was a warmth to it and a charm to it that I didn't necessarily expect.
I think both of you are Nimrods.
Wow. You mean we're great hunters? Thanks very much.
Would you say I'm an American idiot?
I would say you're a Welsh idiot.
Uh-huh. Hey.
Bordering on Welsh idiot. I liked this movie a lot. I liked it a lot more than I was expecting to. I interviewed Mason Thames/Thames and Lee Kirk at Comic-Con, which you'll hear either in next week's show or next week's episode of The Interviews. So we should say this is out on Tuesday, by the way. This isn't out this week. It's not out this Friday, but it's out on Tuesday. But next week's fairly packed, so we're bringing it forward to discuss this week. And even though I never established in that interview how to pronounce Mason's surname, I did establish that I liked the film a lot more than I was expected to, because I'd seen the trailer and I thought, oh, this feels like it's, I don't know, strangely out of touch. I couldn't quite understand the concept of, and I like Green Day. I'm a big fan. I think American Idiot is a masterpiece. But I couldn't quite get my head around the idea that a bunch of 19-year-olds would travel the country to follow Green Day. I couldn't quite... are 19-year-olds into Green Day? I don't know if they are. Maybe they are.
Presumably Green Day knows some who are.
Well, Lee Kirk said that Mason Thames was a big Green Day fan, so he was massively delighted to be in the film. But I don't know. There's got to be bands who are maybe connecting with the youth more than Green Day are. But that aside, I thought it was really sweet. I thought it was surprisingly funny. I thought the characters were better drawn than you think they are. I think Kyler Kaufman is really good as Fred, the green-haired one. These characters are very much in the tradition of characters that you will have seen in a million teen road trip movies. But there's something about the way Lee Kirk shoots this. It's either with a key light or without a key light. I'm not entirely sure. But there's a really lovely, wistful, autumnal tone to this. A lot of stuff was shot kind of around magic hour as the sun was going down. And I think they shot it in winter in February in Nebraska, I think. And so the light was that kind of subdued light that you get at that time of year. And I think that informs the performances and informs the tone for me. And, you know, yeah, the dead dad thing you were talking about there, John, I worked for me tremendously because it's something that is introduced very early in the film. His mother, Mason Thames's mother, Mason River's mum in the film is played by Jenna Fisher, Pam from The Office, who is Lee Kirk's wife.
Yeah, there you go.
In real life. And Angela Kinsey is also in the film, also from The Office, also from the Office Ladies podcast. And that scene really got me. And I think it establishes the stakes. And I think it does explain a lot of what Tommy does in the film. And it doesn't hammer it home that much. But there's a nice kind of subplot about his older brother, who's meant to be the one who was looking after him after their dad died. Which is something, by the way, that came from Billy Joe Armstrong's life.
Okay.
His dad died when he was young as well. So, you know, there's lots of, I think, real emotion here, which worked for me.
Yeah, his brother's played by Keen Ruffalo, as in Son of Mark.
Oh. Holy.
Yeah, oh, baby.
Holy shit. Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. We have the Son of a Hulk. That, oh my God.
The owner of a dragon. The lady of the office.
Dragon. Oh my word.
Is he the guy who played Hulk's son in She-Hulk?
I don't know.
Is that the same one?
He looked less green this time. Yeah. So it's hard to tell.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, I liked it more than you guys.
I still liked it.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Well,
again, like 3 stars.
He was very sniffy. I mean, he was absolutely no. He was like, wake me up when this movie ends.
Right.
Never mind September, because they have a song.
Yeah, no, I know.
Okay. I'll be taking a holiday after this. I don't really know any other tracks.
Chris, your Chex Notes basket case.
Thank you. It's always nice to be compared to one of the great trash classics. Oh, you mean the song, not the film. Okay. So there we go. John, what are we giving this?
3 stars.
3 stars. We spent a lot of time talking about this movie. It was 3 stars. Unbelievable. Would you send a cautionary text to your friends going, do not see this in case you and your friends were fooled into thinking that you were going to be supporting a major rock band?
If they had a bad experience at a Green Day concert, I'd let them know, hey, this film features a Green Day concert. So like, just make up your own mind with that knowledge.
That's a good thing. It's a good thing. Good Green Day songs in this.
No, but I'm saying if they had a bad experience at a Green Day concert, then they might be re-traumatized.
Oh,
look,
I see.
I'm not saying don't go. That's not what I told people. I just said, like, be aware, like, this film may trigger some emotions for you. And all I think there's
Helen, I think it's a good service that you are providing people, and I think you should do it for more films from now on.
All right. I'll
I think you should. You're like the canary down the coal mine. I think you should go see all films first and then text us afterwards going, no, avoid that because...
I do this for you already.
There's a bit where Dr. Doom says something to the thing and you won't like it, so don't go see it.
I do that a little bit for you already.
You do.
You know, on a more limited basis.
Yeah, she's a bellwether. James is a bell end weather. Anyway, 3 stars then for Nimrod's A Green Day Comedy. Do not be put off by the Green Day comedy part. Just focus on the Nimrods.
Yeah, you don't have to be a Green Day fan to work.
Don't have to be. It's not compulsory. So there we go. Anyway, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by either Matt Johnson, making his second appearance on the Empire Podcast in a matter of weeks after Nirvana, the band, to show the movie. Mm-hmm. His new movie is director Tony, which is a kind of biopic of the young Anthony Bourdain, starring Dominic Sessa. He'll be talking to us about that movie, or it'll be the aforementioned Lee Kirk and Mason Thames.
Oh, God.
Mason, I think I'm getting it right. But it might be Masson.
Masson.
We don't know.
Masson Thames.
Masson to Hemes.
Masson to Hemes. That's his new name going forward. So, yeah. So it'll be one of those two people. That's exciting. Actually, 3 people because it's Lee Kirk as well.
Okay.
So there we go. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it's time to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, John Nugent.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to have a listen to that new Welsh dub of Star Wars. Do you think they get round to The Phantom Menace? How would you do a Welsh Jar Jar?
I guess you start
John.
Off.
How would you do a Welsh Jar Jar? Do you want a Jar Jar line?
Yeah. Give me a line.
He goes, you're thinking you're people going to die?
Oh, you're people. That's
demanded by the gods, it is. I don't know. Is that Welsh?
Definitely not.
Who could tell?
How rude. I don't know. I think it's a hate crime.
He's a liking this.
Yeah.
Keys.
Yeah, Boss Nass is a lot easier to
Boss
do in Welsh.
Boss Nass. Yeah, so much easier. All right. This
definitely
Welsh dub.
A hate crime.
It's not a hate crime. It's we love the crime. Welsh. And we love the Welsh accent and we love the Welsh language.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Goodbye.